The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Chief Judge Siegel, and Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Judge Francis Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Our first case this morning is A20-1401. I hope I pronounced this correctly. Michelle Krachik versus Gregory Scott Aberle, formerly known as Gregory Scott Peterson. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes. And then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before we get started, I just wish to remind both the counsel and all guests watching that this argument is being recorded on audio. However, court rules prohibit anyone from privately recording it on either a video or audio fashion. So please keep that in mind. With that, counsel for the appellant, if you'd like to begin, just please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you. And may it please the court and counsel. My name is John Westrick, W-E-S-T-R-I-C-K, and I represent the appellant, Gregory Aberle. The questions that we're addressing here today are mixed questions of law and fact or questions of law. There are very few disputes, if any, with the facts as found by the trial court. From our reading and from the facts established by the trial court, it is the appellant's contention and has been throughout this proceeding that the claims brought by the respondent are barred by the applicable statutes of limitations. Notably, the respondent was informed by the appellant that she did not have money in the stock market, which the court found the respondent has acknowledged was the basis for the agreement and which forms any basis for a breach of fiduciary duty or a breach of contract sometime in May of 2010, and she was told she had a loss, and she had been told previously that the money had been placed with an accountant. Now, it doesn't matter whether those statements were true or not. It doesn't, because what they didn't do was conceal the cause of action, not do we know all the details of the cause of action. And I think that that is the distinction that needs to be made here, because as of these early dates, the respondent was aware that her agreement was breached, they weren't following the agreement, and that she suffered a loss. The other agreement being, I can withdraw the money at any time, and she was told, no, she could not do that. So
Mr.
the fact that-
Westrick, if I could interrupt for a minute.
Of course.
On appeal, we defer to district court credibility findings. And so how do you get around that in your argument? I mean, fraudulent concealment, there she found the facts to support that. And what's your best argument there on that issue?
It's a simple argument. It's that, first of all, facts as to dates are easily found clearly erroneous or not. If the fact says it was May 16th, 2010, and it's actually February 16th, 2010, it's an easy thing to do. But to determine a fraudulent concealment is both a finding of fact and a conclusion of law. And we're saying that, especially if you look at the Hydromac case, that because there was evidence presented in the record showing that the plaintiff was aware of the cause of action, that that precludes, as a matter of law, a finding of concealment. Remember, everything that the judge said about what Mr. Aberle did or didn't do to attempt to conceal the true facts may well be true, but concealing the facts is not concealing the cause of action. She knew she had a cause of action. Yes.
If I can just follow up quickly on Judge Siegel's question, I don't mean to interrupt, but you said that, if I'm following you right, that you're making an argument, not that the district court was clearly erroneous, but that on fraudulent concealment, but that the district court basically added up the facts incorrectly. Am I right?
That is correct. Okay.
As I understand it, you're claiming there's a legal error under Hydromac?
Yes.
Okay. So can you tell me exactly what the legal error is? And let's just say on the breach of contract claim.
Okay. So the legal error on the breach of contract claim is the judge conflated the idea of Ms. or the respondent knowing what her money had been used for with the idea of knowing that her money had been misused. It is the fact that she knew her money wasn't being used as she had contracted for that raises the cause of action, not the fact that she might or might not have known how the money was misused. So by analogy, it wouldn't matter whether Mr. Aberle had used this to buy the property or a brand new Corvette. She didn't need to know how he misused the money. What she had to know to have a cause of action is that he misused the money.
So help me out. What is their agreement as to how Mr. Aberle was going to use the money? And if you could refer to the district court's findings, since you're telling me you don't dispute them, that helps. But
certainly. So the district court found that respondent did not give appellant carte blanche to use her money. The district court found, this is finding 48 and order at conclusion 49, that respondent authorized Mr. Aberle to invest her money in the stock market.
And he did, right? He did initially invest
in the stock market. Yes.
And then he used it to buy a building.
No.
Well, he did eventually. Yeah.
Eventually, yes.
2008, right?
Yes.
And you don't dispute that, right? That's
no.
Also a finding. Yeah, okay.
So
did they have an agreement that he could use her money to buy the building?
No.
Okay. And he didn't tell her that he bought the building until 2011?
Later. Something like that. There's a finding on it, yes.
So I think that's the basis for the district court's fraudulent concealment determination, at least on breach of contract. And
I agree.
And you're disputing the findings of fact. So I'm still struggling with where the legal error is.
Okay. The legal error is it doesn't matter how he misused the money or when she learned how Mr. Aberle misused the money. It was only once she found out that the money was not in the stock market. That was a breach. The trial court found, and she testified.
So Mr. Westrick, let me just explain why. I read that in your brief, so I'm not interrupting you because I don't think you have something valuable to say. I really do understand, I think, your argument. You can totally correct me if I'm wrong. Here's what I'm struggling with. If they did not have an agreement, and you've already said that, so the plaintiff did not allow Mr. Aberle, did not agree to let Mr. Aberle use her money to buy a building or any other property. And he did, and he didn't disclose it. Isn't that fraudulent concealment of that particular breach of contract? Because he breached their contract. He promised to invest it. He didn't. He bought a property.
No.
Okay.
The breach of contract was when he took it out of the stock market.
Mr. Westrick, can I interrupt you? Do you have any case law saying that the first time somebody breaches a contract, that's the running of the statute of limitations the first time, even if Ms. Krawczyk didn't view that as a material breach? I mean, that's, you know, what do you have any case law to that effect? Because that seems to be what you're arguing, is that, well, stock market, this wasn't the stock market. And so she knew that. So she knew the contract was breached. But my understanding of contract law, and I haven't practiced in this area in quite a long time, but is that, you know, the statute doesn't necessarily run at the first time you're aware that something's a little different, particularly this is an oral agreement, right? And so she was like, oh, okay, all right, I get that. That's okay.
The cause of action accrues when it would survive a defendant's motion to dismiss for failure to state a cause of action. And there is nothing in the record from the respondent that would say his failure to invest in the stock market was not a material breach. Indeed, it was cited as a material breach from the get-go, the failure to put it in the stock market. So when she testified and the court found, the agreement was the money would be in the stock market. That was the breach. The breach isn't that he bought a building with it. The breach is that he took it out of the stock market. Later it was in bonds, supposedly. And the court found that was all malarkey. I'm not challenging any of that. What I'm saying is the minute she found out it wasn't in the stock market, and then about a year later, she found out not only was it not in the stock market, but she couldn't withdraw her money at any time, which again, the district court found was part and parcel of their agreement.
Wasn't that an amendment to the agreement? I mean, why she knew it. It was like, oh, okay, I don't like this, but I'll go along with it.
Well, but there's no evidence of that. She never testified I went along with it. There was no evidence ever presented that this was the change.
And well,
this
she is did. I mean, can't we infer that? Because she didn't sue. She didn't like it, but she didn't sue.
Well,
I mean, but then so you go. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Go ahead. I've done this a long time. I've been interrupted a lot more than this. So my point is that she alleged that was a material breach of contract, and that she so the later when she couldn't get her money out and she'd done damage, that was still 6 years and 7 months before she brought the claim. But yet she doesn't get to pick and choose. What's good for the goose is good for the gander here. So when the judge makes a finding and she testifies, this is the agreement, the funds must be used for this purpose, and I am entitled to withdraw my money at any time, and I find all of that is not true, and I've lost money as a result, that tells me she has a perfectly formed breach of contract action, which really just follows along with the fraudulent concealment. And so if you look at the cases I've cited, they talk about you can't extend this thing, and it accrues at the time of the breach. And nowhere along does someone say, well, we have modified the agreement or we did the agreement. There isn't anything that says that. As a matter of fact, the testimony was clear that there would be years and long periods of time without them discussing anything. There's no email that says, okay, Mr. Aberle, you shouldn't have invested this the way you did, but that's okay with me. Because if, in fact, Mr. Aberle did have the discretion and she could say, well, I didn't say anything, so it's waived, then this whole thing falls down because then it doesn't matter what their agreement was, because by not suing right away, she would, under your theory, that would mean she would have agreed to the modification and ratified the agreement, which was one of the...
So as I understand it, then you're saying that the cause of action accrued in May 18, 2010, when she was told that the funds are in bonds, not the stock market.
Actually, it accrued before even that. The first time it accrued is when she was told it was with an accountant and not in the stock market. That would have been the first time. The second time would have been, even if the first wasn't, when it was in bonds and she had suffered a loss and she could not withdraw her money from the account, as she said, and the district court found. Remember, the district court's findings bind not only my client, but they bind the respondent as well. That the district court found that that was a breach of the agreement, that the agreement was she would be able to withdraw her money at any time. And so once we have that, and then those really are the same breaches of fiduciary duty claims. I do just briefly want to go...
I mean, you know, the bottom line is the when your client said that, the money was neither with the accountant nor in bonds. Would that be a fair statement?
That would be a later date that would also have accrued if the first one didn't, yes. So I do just want to discuss the last two legal issues very briefly. There is no claim for unjust enrichment here because respondent has a remedy at law.
Right, and I think that you have a good point there, Mr. Westrick. I'm curious what Mr. Eaton has to say about it. I've read both of your briefs. So here's my question. Have you ever raised that before, either during district court proceedings or in your motion for judgment as a matter of law? I couldn't find it. I looked for it.
I raised it as an affirmative defense, and I thought I did raise it, but as you sit here, I only have the briefs in front of me, so I can't answer to you whether I did. Would you like me to send you a letter to tell you whether I did that or not?
That's what we need you to put in your brief, is how you preserve the error. That's part of the appellate rules, all right? Okay. If you want to supplement your brief now, there's a rule for that, too. Feel free.
Okay.
But I think you're in trouble here. I don't see where it's been raised at all in district court. It certainly wasn't in your motion for judgment as a matter of law. So if that's true, then, you know, haven't you really let the district court go ahead on this theory that the plaintiff could recover under unjustment, enrichment, and contract? So I, you know, it looks to me like you haven't preserved that error and it's not in front of us.
Well, if I didn't preserve it, then I've waived it. The rule's pretty clear. So I will look at it and let the court know. I also believe that because of the nature of the funds transfer here, the civil theft statute doesn't apply. And I went into that. Really, the same analysis that I made with respect to the statute of limitations, I hope you didn't fall asleep, got a little repetitive because it was just over and over again. But to me, the accrual points in one of these two positions and all of the statutes ran. And unless there's questions, I see I have 6 seconds and I'll wait till my rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Westrick, and you will have rebuttal. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, and may it please the court. Daniel Eaton for respondent Michelle Krozik. So as the court has established, in this case, the appellant doesn't dispute that he acted wrongly. His primary defense is that his bad acts were so obvious that Michelle Krozik should have discovered his wrongdoing sooner than she did. And the facts of Mr. Averly's bad acting are quite clear. In 2008, 3 years after Ms. Krozik invested $50,000 with him, Mr. Averly found himself in need of money so he could redeem a family-owned commercial property from foreclosure. The money he had at his disposal was that of Ms. Krozik and her fellow investors. So Averly cooked up a scheme where he told Ms. Krozik that he made a strategic decision to take her money out of the stock market and temporarily park it in bonds for safekeeping. But the reality is, as the court knows, he used that money to buy this building, to redeem it from foreclosure. He kept up this ruse for 3 years, continuing to tell her that her money was in bonds. And it was only after Mr. Averly's scheme started falling apart and he was at risk of losing all of Ms. Krozik's money that he told her about this property, and then attempting to recharacterize it as an investment of Ms. Krozik's money. And when the property was eventually taken by eminent domain, he really saw to it that his friends and family got paid back, but not Ms. Krozik. And the district court found that Mr. Averly lied to Ms. Krozik in order to conceal his actions, and that Ms. Krozik had no knowledge of his true actions, and therefore no basis for legal claims, until Averly told her that her money had in fact not been safely on the sidelines, but rather had been used to purchase Averly's property, which he eventually lost. And so Mr. Averly's argument isn't that he didn't steal Ms. Krozik's money. His argument is that while he was robbing her blind, that she should have seen it coming.
So, and Mr. Eaton, I think just to kind of put you right exactly in response to Mr. Westrick's argument, I'd like you to just focus in on the breach of contract claim, because I think that's where he started. And he said that Ms. Krozik should have, at the point that she found out that Mr. Averly had pulled her money out of the stock market and had put it on the sidelines with an accountant, even though that's a lie, he says that that is the point at which she should have known, hey, the agreement for him to invest in the stock market is breached. So what's your response to that?
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. So the first part of that response is just to go back to the fact that this is, it, the analysis here is clear error. And so the court can only this court can only reverse the district court if it finds that that the decision was clearly erroneous. And this goes to the question of when Ms. Krawczyk became aware or should have become aware of her legal claims. And I understand appellant's arguments that, well, when Mr. Aberle told her the money was in bonds and not in the stock market, that was a breach of the contract. But that's not what the district court found. And this court only needs to determine that there's reasonable evidence in the record to support the district court's findings. And this court can only reverse if there's a definite and firm conviction here that the district court made a mistake. And so I'll direct this court to a few of the findings in the district court's decision that I think are squarely refute Mr. Aberle's position. So starting with some conclusions of law, paragraphs 30 through 32, the court found that Mr. Aberle's email on March 1st, 2011, quote, is the earliest possible date that Ms. Krawczyk could have discovered Aberle's breach of fiduciary duty and breach of contract because of Mr. Aberle's fraudulent statements. It found, quote, no amount of reasonable diligence on Ms. Krawczyk's part would have made her aware of Mr. Aberle's breach prior to March 1st, 2011, because Mr. Aberle made material misrepresentations to her to conceal his misappropriation, and she had no reason up to that point to doubt the advice she received from Mr. Aberle as an expert and investment professional. Quote, even after Mr. Aberle disclosed to Ms. Krawczyk in March 2011 that her money was in a building, he continued to make representations to her about returning her investment, including representing to her that he would take a loss on the property before she would take a loss, which led her to believe he was still working in her best interests. And some of the additional findings. So in findings of fact, paragraphs 88 through 91.
Mr. Eden, before you get to that, what was the oral agreement that your client had with Mr. Westrick's client? Was it just invested in the stock market only? Or, I mean, I thought it was just sort of, you know, invest my money and...
Right.
And it was a little more vague than just, you know, I mean, it certainly wasn't like, I mean, I know there was reference that he only gets a commission if, you know, he exceeds the S&P 500. But I mean, the agreement was not like, you know, only buy blue chip stocks or only buy growth stocks or, I mean, what was this agreement that your client had with Mr. Westrick's client?
So, and yeah, this is where, a big part of Mr. Aberle's argument falls apart is what, you know, Mr. Westrick on Mr. Aberle's behalf is trying to do is parse out, well, the only way to invest in the stock market is to be fully invested, you know, have your money in stocks at all times. But there are other methods of investing and one method of investing in the stock market is only having your money in stocks when the conditions are right, and then pulling it out when you don't see that they're right. And that's exactly what Mr. Aberle claimed that his strategy was. And if we look at the January 6th...
If I can just ask you a quick question.
Yes.
Along those lines. So you're saying that the agreement to invest is one that gave Mr. Aberle some discretion. And it sounds to me like you're alluding to the fact that the district court found Mr. Aberle and Ms. Krawczyk were in a fiduciary relationship. And as I see appellant's brief, and he can correct me in rebuttal, I don't see a challenge to that determination. They were in a fiduciary relationship. And doesn't that affect the fraudulent concealment analysis? It seems to me it does under the law.
Yeah, it does, because he was, regardless, he had to act as her fiduciary, and he was not. And so, and there is a, there's a lower bar to get over for a breach of fiduciary duty claim. He doesn't necessarily need to fraudulently conceal because he just wasn't acting in her.
Right. If I understand the case law, right, it actually goes so far as to say when they're in a fiduciary relationship, there might be the duty. There is the duty to speak. That actual silence can even be a breach. Isn't that right?
That's true.
And would count as concealment, which seems to me, I mean, I'm just reading between the lines in the district court's order, but it sounds to me like it changes the analysis on fraudulent concealment.
Yeah, it does. Because it does create a greater responsibility on Mr. Haberle's part. And if he's not acting in her best interest, then he is breaching his fiduciary duty.
So, counsel, would you turn to the civil theft claim? Because it seems to me that there are some arguments there that are interesting, relating to whether we've got the TCI case, which is rejected a conversion claim where the money is non-intangible form. And it seems to me Mr. Westrick's arguing that we should do the same with the civil theft statute. So how do you respond to that?
Sure. So this has been addressed. We rely heavily on the TCI case. And in that case, the court very clearly finds that civil theft can be applied to electronic transactions like this. And it does not need to, we don't need to look at just tangible money. I don't think there's really any dispute.
So I'm a little troubled by that reading of TCI because TCI actually did reverse the summary judgment on civil theft. It didn't do it for this reason, the electronic, state of the money involved. It did it because it said there wasn't a theft. There was no stealing, which is another argument Mr. Westrick's making. But I don't see where our case law has decided whether civil theft applies to the money in its electronic form. So help me out there.
Well, I think that if you look at how money is stolen, particularly today, this is how it happens. It's rare that someone's going to just steal cash, and so it's logical that it would apply to this situation. I agree that there is limited case law on this. And I think the TCI case is the best guidance that we have. And again, in that case, the court didn't rule out civil theft on the basis that it was not tangible money, but it did rule out conversion for that reason.
So what about Mr. Westrick's argument that the district court's findings don't show stealing under the civil theft statute because Ms. Krawczyk gave Mr. Haberle the money?
I did not find that there's actual support for that authority for that contention. But under this, just because she initially voluntarily gave him her money under the understanding that he was going to invest it, she still didn't authorize him to do anything that he wanted with it. She didn't authorize him to buy the money or use the money for his land. She didn't authorize him to use it for his personal gain. And I think the real distinction here is that this was never his money. She didn't give it to him. She entrusted it with him to invest, but it still was her money. There's no question that that it was still hers. He just had control of it at that point.
I just one quick question at the end on unjust enrichment. I read your brief to say you don't disagree with the legal point that Mr. Westrick is making. Am I wrong about that? That you don't get a plaintiff does not get to recover in both breach of contract and unjust enrichment for the same thing.
Right. The Ms. Krasick is not entitled to duplicative damages due to unjust enrichment. If the breach of contract claim failed, then the unjust enrichment would be a alternative claim.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Eaton. Mr. Westrick, you'll have the last word, please.
Thank you, Your Honors. Again, may it please the court. The first thing I want to point out is Mr. Eaton has discussed the court's conclusions and then talked about clearly erroneous. Remember, the trial court's findings are viewed to be clearly erroneous. The trial court's conclusions are viewed de novo. And that's an important distinction here when looking at this. I do disagree that the knowledge of Mr. Aberle's true actions, that is not the test. Concealment is when she should have known, but a breach of contract is an objective finding. So how this gets done, and I picked up that the court's not terribly keen on my arguments here.
Observation, Mr. Westrick. Mr. Westrick, what was this agreement? I mean, that your client had with Mr. Eaton's client. I mean, does the evidence support that it was, here's 50 grand, I only want it in the stock market, or I mean, I read it as just here's 50 grand, you know, invest it, and you know best, you're the whiz kid. What evidence would I look for to say the agreement was it's the stock market only, so that your argument that it's anything but that, she's on notice? Where would I find that in the record? I mean, your client didn't testify, right?
No, he did. He was called for cross-examination.
I apologize. Did he say on the stand the investment was for the stock market only and nothing else?
No, I believe, I don't have the transcript in front of me, but I believe he testified it was more discretionary. It's the trial court that made the finding that the investment was only to be in the stock market. It's the respondent who testified at page 68, lines 17 and 18, that it was only to be put into the stock market. So the trial court made a finding that the money was only to be in the stock market. Because he rejected Mr. Aberle's claim, it was discretionary. Because if it was Mr. Aberle's claim, it was discretionary, we'd have a very different case here. And so that my point I've been trying to make here, somewhat unsuccessfully, is that the findings of the trial court that the money was to be used X, they don't just bind the appellant. They're not just clearly erroneous for the appellant, but they have to be clearly erroneous for the respondent as well, and they bind the respondent. And so when the trial court makes that finding, you, me, Mr. Eaton, we're all kind of stuck with it, unless it's clearly erroneous. And we have asserted that it's not, because it isn't.
And if I could just underscore that for a second, because I just want to make sure I'm not confused about your argument. You are not claiming that the district court clearly erred in any of its findings of fact, right?
Correct. But we are saying that some of his findings, such as at the date at which someone did or did not was not aware, that's not just a finding of fact. That's a mixed question of law and fact. And so there's going to be a, as I call, some kind of nebulous de novo aspect to it. And I will leave it to you three to figure out what that nebulous aspect is, because I'm not really sure myself, having never sat on a bench. And so, again, our whole argument here is that, and by the way, it was Mr. Aberle's money. She acknowledged she never filled out an account form. She made the check payable to Mr. Aberle or Mr. Aberle's Investment Answers, which was a sole proprietorship. So the money was given to her. So that's another reason why there wasn't a civil theft. I did want to point out when Mr. Eaton said, well, these days, this is how money is stolen. Well, the TCI case was from 2017. We're not relying on something from 1857. And so our view is that using the trial court's findings, as we must, as the roadmap, that the statute of limitations ran and that the fraudulent concealment didn't happen because she knew, respondent, enough to know that she had causes of action long before the matter was sued out. If the court doesn't have any more questions, I'll yield the rest of my time, and my client and I thank the court for its time and attention to the matter. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't believe we do. Thank you very much, Mr. Eaton. Thank you very much, Mr. Westrick.